As an adapting listener, you won't want to miss the Jewish Education Project's spring event on Tuesday, May 21st in New York City. Join us for an inspiring conversation on the role of education in strengthening Jewish identity, fortitude, and the Jewish future with film and stage actor and podcast host Josh Molina. You can register via the link in the show notes. Hi, everybody, and we're recording today's episode of Adapting on April 10, 2024, and we're releasing this episode just before Pesach, the Festival of Freedom. And I think for everybody who is celebrating Passover this year, it's going to be an interesting, if not difficult, time to bring together a family, because I think many of the themes of Pesach are going to have different resonance this year when we're talking about things like the Festival of Freedom, or when we're talking about Moses asking Pharaoh to let my people go. And I think in many ways, that's the part of today's episode which I want everybody to be thinking about, or at least in the background, because we want to take you all on the journey of one particular educator whose philosophy and attitude about Jewish education has changed fairly significantly since October 7th. And we're not just trying to talk just about Ilana Gleischer-Bloom and her particular journey, but use this episode as a way for all of us to reflect on what has changed, what may have stayed the same as a result of those events. And I think today's episode is one where we can really hear the struggles and the conflicts that we have as human beings, as Jews, as Jewish educators, as Israel educators, but particularly when we're talking about Pesach and what's going to be coming up for all of us when we sit at our Passover Seders with our children, with our families, that this Pesach is not going to be Passover as usual. There are going to be a different resonance. And I think that's because all of us are different. We've all changed. And today's episode is one where we get to explore some of those changes directly with one really, really great Jewish educator. Thank you as always for listening today. And I'm sure you'll get as much out of this episode as I did.
This is Adapting, the Future of Jewish Education, a podcast from the Jewish Education Project, where we explore the big questions, challenges, and successes that define Jewish education. I'm David Breifman.
Ilana Gleischer-Bloom has worked as a Jewish educator and education director for over 15 years. Most recently, she developed the Mensch Academy as part of Mishkan Chicago, and she now lives and works in Israel as a director of experiential education at the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. She is also the recipient of the prestigious Pomegranate Prize from the Covenant Foundation, which honors rising leaders in Jewish education. And Ilana, thanks so much for joining us on Adapting today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start by offering the audience a bit about your own professional journey and how you got to where you are today.
Okay. I always really liked learning Torah and learning Jewish philosophy, even in like when I was in high school and even in middle school around my bat mitzvah age. And I just really thought, I don't know, I thought it was like cool and interesting. I grew up in the Orthodox world. I went to Mount Orthodox day school. I was a very day school person. I went to Midrashat Linnabaum, spent a year learning. I went to Brandeis, where I was able to study Judaic studies. And then I wasn't sure what to do. And I went to Israel for a year after college, and I actually ended up at Pardes, which I had never even heard of. And I decided I wanted to be a Jewish educator, then went to a program after Pardes at Hartman, which doesn't exist any longer, but it was called Malamdim, and it was a program to train educators in North America and in Israel. It was a two-year program with a master's at Tel Aviv University. And after that, I taught in day schools. I taught Talmud and Tanakh in the high school level at the Heschel School in Manhattan and at Rochelle Zell High School in Chicago. And after a lot of years spent in high school education, I was looking for something different. And Mishkan Chicago, which is a spiritual community in Chicago, they were looking for someone to start an education program for kids. That was it. Like, it was a very broad mandate. And they just wanted someone to start something new and interesting. And I thought this would be a really interesting opportunity to move from day school and to actually start something new. So I moved into the world of congregational education, and I worked there for six years. And then during COVID, it was really on a whim, sort of. We decided that, you know what, things are not going so well for us as a family here right now. And we thought, you know what, why don't we just see if we can go to Israel just for a year and try it out? And we just, in 4 weeks, moved to Israel for what we said was a year. And now, 2.5 years later, we're still in Israel.
So as someone who grew up in an Orthodox Jewish day school in an Orthodox environment, now working in non-Orthodox or pluralist Jewish settings, how does that transition feel to you today?
When I was younger, I always imagined that I would stay in the Orthodox world and work in the Orthodox world because I thought that it was important to, like, even though I always saw myself on the fringe of the Orthodox world, I was like, I'm going to stay inside to make change from within. And I decided actually that I didn't want to do that. I wanted to actually be able to support learners of all kinds within and without of the Orthodox world. I think it's important for everyone to access Torah. At first, when I was really interested in Torah learning when I was in high school, I thought everyone should be able to access Torah, even kids like me who are, you know, have a lot of cynical questions. Teachers really hated my questions. They would tell me not to ask questions and tell me to stay quiet. And I always thought, you know what, one day I'm going to be one of these teachers and I'm not going to tell students to not ask questions. And then as I got older, I thought everyone should be able to access Torah. You shouldn't have to have come from an Orthodox background. Like, everyone should be able to access Torah. And then I started saying everyone should be able to access Torah no matter what their political beliefs are. Everyone should be able to access Torah no matter, like, it kept being my whole path has been everyone should be able to access Torah. And it always was about trying to include anyone who might be on the outside.
So today's conversation with you is going to focus a bit about your own pedagogical, philosophically, educationally infused journey. But in order to get there and understand how your journey has changed a bit over time, we need to give the audience a bit of context about at least two of the organizations with whom you work and whom you currently work. So let's give the audience like a two-sentence overview of what is the Mensch Academy at Mishkan Chicago.
Mensch Academy at Mishkan Chicago is an after-school supplementary education program that is part of Mishkan Chicago, which is a spiritual community, not a synagogue, spiritual community. I had the opportunity to research for a year to develop it, and I decided the focus should be on kids being able to access Torah, of course, back to the original line. And it's 2 hours a week, what the community wanted. And it made the most sense. And so I felt like we had to be able to say, this is what we do. And there are also a lot of things that we don't do. But the main thing that we did was allowing students to access Torah.
So why did you call it a Mensch Academy and not a religious school?
Honestly, when I was hired, I was told you should create a program for kids, for families. We don't even know, like, do what you think is best, research and figure it out. The one rule is that this is called Mensch Academy. Like, that's the only thing I had that was known. It was Lizzie named it Mensch Academy from the beginning. And that was the thing that was not changing.
Okay. The connotation here is that the Mensch Academy is designed to create human beings or Jewish human beings who are infused with Torah in their life, I would imagine, as opposed to learning particular skills or religious precepts that might be associated with traditional religious schools, I guess.
Yes. It was about finding ways for the students to be able to access Torah and find meaning in Torah. So we didn't give them stories about Torah. We gave them direct text with translation, but direct text. And then we gave them the space to find their own meaning and their own ideas within that text and to develop their own interpretation, which I believe allows them to become empowered, confident Jews in the world.
Now, without going too much detail now, but it is important for our conversation. What role did Israel and Israel education have in the Mensch Academy?
We did not. The way that I framed it was that I thought it was really important to have boundaries about what we can and cannot do. They didn't know much Hebrew. There was a few bits of Hebrew that were brought in. There's a lot of things that you don't learn when you're only there for 2 hours a week. And so the way that I looked at it was we're focusing on text, on Jewish text, and everything else we're just not focusing on. I did, however, before COVID, I started thinking about how we should do Israel education. I wanted to launch Israel education for our seventh graders, and I had started thinking about what that could look like. The Mensch Academy model is that you have text. It's about primary sources and interpreting and analyzing those sources. And so I imagined that with Israel education, we might be able to do something similar. However, COVID happened and we had to rebuild everything.
So now you and your family have picked up and you've moved to Israel, I must add, during COVID. Okay, we can talk about what that meant for you and your family. But you've now picked up a job working at Pardes, and listeners will remember that we've had some discussions with with Pardes faculty before in the past about the role of Jewish education coming out of Israel and why it's so important. And your role there is now, explain to the audience what it is that you do there now, and we'll talk a bit about the role that Israel plays in that now moving forward.
So I am the director of experiential education at Pardes. More specifically, within Pardes, I work at the Pardes Center for Jewish Educators, which is, we train and support Jewish educators all over the world. So it's about training the educators. And so what I do as the director of experiential education is I run programs for people who want to be experiential educators.
So I want to use this episode as a bit of an exploration of your own journey, partly because I think it's a really interesting and fascinating journey in and of itself, but also because I think it's a journey which many educators may or may not have been going through prior to October 7th, but in particular after October 7th, they're asking many of the questions that I think you began to ask yourself and then you began to share publicly as a result of what was transpiring in your own thinking about Jewish education. So let's now talk about how you see the role of Israel in Jewish education today. What language would you use to describe whether it's important, integral, central, peripheral? How would you describe the role of Israel in Jewish education today?
I think that in order to be a Jewish educator, because I'm thinking of the context of how I teach teachers, in order to be a Jewish educator, you have to have something to say about Israel. Let's like start with that, just a really broad statement. And I think that part of the work that I did at Mensch Academy was that I started the religious school there, but I also spent a lot of time training the educators. Part of the model that I implemented there was that the educators were teaching 2 hours during the day, but they were learning and prepping with me and being trained for 3 to 4 hours before that. So it was like a school for the students and the kids, but it was also like a school for these educators. And because I wasn't teaching about Israel, I made the decision that it didn't matter what the educators thought or if they had any opinion about Israel. And I think that after October 7th, it doesn't feel right to send educators into the field, Jewish educators, who don't have something to say about Israel. Like, I'm leaving it broad on purpose. I'm not saying that every Jewish educator needs to be like a very ardent supporter of Israel and its government at all times. But I am saying that you need to have something to contribute to the conversation about Israel. I want them to work on developing their Israel story. What is it? Not that that's what they're going to teach. I don't think they're going to teach, well, I think this about Israel, but I want them to at least come to the table with what they think about Israel and give them enough confidence to be able to at least know that they have something to say. I want to be clear that this is something that I'm developing and building and thinking about in real time. So just to clarify that, because it's still like a war time and it's still, I'm responding to that, to the war, I think, in this educational way. But I just want to be clear that's also the reality.
Just for listeners, it's now 6 months after October 7th, and we're not going to hold Ilana accountable for the rest of her educational journey for things that she says today. But I think the fact that she's talking about being on a journey is still really important for all of us to take note and heed of, that what we're thinking today may or may not be what we think in a month's or year's time, but what we are thinking today does infuse how we are going to move forward thinking about it. So I think getting into the background of your journey here is actually really important. So keep going as to like, I really want to get to the point of like, if you're not going to be specifically teaching about Israel, why is it important for a Jewish educator to still have their own Israel story to be able to at least know and articulate if being called upon to do so?
Okay, so there's two things that I think about on this. My first, like the first gut response to that question is they need to be prepared because every educator has become an Israel educator just post October 7th. I work with a lot of synagogue educators, and they were telling me about how they now are doing so much more work than they were doing before October 7th because they're now like the Israel educator. They are not particularly trained to be Israel educators, but they're now running like processing groups, or all of a sudden it's like a teen group on how do we talk about Israel in our schools? Or there's like the board is doing a group about like, how do we respond? And you as the educator often will be brought into that, whether you like it or not. So that's one. My second response is more of my October 8th response or October 20th, sometime in October, is that Rachel Goldberg works at Pardes. her son is in Gaza still. From October 7th in the evening, maybe, there were already texts and WhatsApps going out saying that Hirsch was missing and that Honor, his friend, they were both missing and no one knew what to do. And the only thing you could do to help them was to spread the word as much as possible. And through in those first few weeks after, I felt completely helpless. Like, it was just awful. First of all the hostages, knowing they're all there. And then knowing that someone who I adore personally, that her son has been kidnapped to Gaza, and knowing that I can't do anything about it except publicize it as much as possible. And so I shared on every social media place I could, contact your reps, call the president, do whatever you can. And I also reached out to anyone who I knew in the US who I felt like had big, like a big platform. And there were people, Jewish educators, rabbis, et cetera, who didn't share, who did not want to share publicly about the hostages because it was too, I don't know, like they don't share about Israel in public forums, was what I was told. And so that to me is a sign that something is wrong. If you feel like, so on the one hand, educators are being told, hey, you got to lead us something about Israel. On the other hand, I, as someone who's living in Israel, I'm reaching out to Jewish institutions in America and being told, well, we don't share publicly about Israel, about the hostages. If you can't like stand up and have something to say, like around the issue of the hostages, which shouldn't be a political left-wing, right-wing issue, if you don't even have like the courage to do that, that's problematic. And so that was when I was like, oh my God, what is going on here? How is this real? How can they, like this person, her child has been kidnapped and you can't post about it? What? And then I felt people need to be like, we need more education around this somehow.
So for the sake of the audience, and I can see this, tell the audience a bit about your safe room.
So the safe room is what we use as our office. It's just, I mean, it looks like a regular room. It has a desk and a Peloton bike, two essentials that you need in a safe room. It's we actually didn't have our steel door on October 7th. We had to get it installed, but it has a steel window frame and it's apparently bomb-proof.
So you've been working as a Jewish educator for a few decades, at least a couple of decades. Israel was interesting to you always, but not central to your Jewish educational philosophy. Over time, it's developed where you're now saying Israel is important for all Jewish educators for a variety of reasons. And then you have the personal now connection where you're saying Israel is central for you on your personal mission. So in a real interesting way, in a real visceral way, the professional and the personal connected on October 7th for you in a way no one expected, but for you now the two are almost inseparable, which I think is how many educators are feeling today. But in your case, it's actually visceral and personal and just really immediate to you as well.
Yeah, because I think in Israel, so many people started doing things to help on October 7th and, you know, like donating blood, donating meals, giving food. And I did some of that too, but it's like the way that I can help is through education because that's what I do. That's my work. And so I have been trying to think about like, how can I help in some way through the lens of education? What does that look like?
And the educator as helper is an interesting metaphor. We used it a lot during COVID where we were literally invoking Fred Rogers and his notion of the educator as helper. And now you're talking about the role of educator as helper in a very different way.
Yeah. I think it's important that we actually talk about Israel as Jewish educators. That's the thing. And I see the way that I can help is by helping people have those conversations that they might be afraid to have, or they might think it's not really relevant to what I'm doing. I'm going to push it aside. But I think that I want educators to think about not only like their stance on Israel, but how do they engage with people who have different takes on Israel? How can we use this moment to actually be in conversation and allow for different approaches to thinking about Israel? And how can educators help support that goal?
And I guess that brings us to the most recent article that you wrote, or that at least that I think you wrote, most recently I think you wrote, when it comes to Israel education, turn to the Beit Midrash and explain that article briefly to our audience And then I'll try and argue with you why I think there was almost an inherent contradiction in your article and your thesis about Israel education, which I think is not necessarily a bad contradiction, but I do think it's somewhat of a paradox. And let's get into it. So the major thesis of your article was what? You tell the audience what you were proposing here.
I'm proposing that just like you study Torah by learning in chavruta, and not chavruta learning doesn't mean only that you're learning with a partner, but you're learning with someone who's there to support you, but also challenge you. And you're having real conversations with that person around the text. And it is okay and even encouraged to disagree with each other and to help each other learn and grow. And what I am saying is that I think that we need to think that way about Israel as well. Through a trusting chavruta relationship, we can get to a place where we can disagree with each other and still be in the same room together and still study together and still learn together, but actually talk it out. That's what I'm saying.
Good. So let's break it down. You're saying that a very true and tried method of Jewish learning is the chavruta model, where a partnership of Jewish learning is built around trust and mutual respect. If there's disagreement, that's great. But because you've got that one-on-one relationship with somebody, you're able to engage in this really fierce discourse with them. And at the end of the day, you're still going to be friends. And it's not surprising the word chavruta has the root of the word chaver or friend. And we bring that all together in a Jewish context quite regularly. And now you're suggesting we apply to the Israel world.
Yes.
And in that context, the notion of machloket or debate is not only important, but actually encouraged.
Yes.
Now, here's where I have the problem.
Okay, go for it.
In your experience, have you found Jewish places of learning where you've had enough contrast or enough distinction between learners that you've been able to see the real divide within Israel education or Israel political, social, religious life actually occur? So are you suggesting that this is a real-time disagreement between learners, or is it somewhat still constrained and too narrow for what we're actually talking about?
No, I think this is real. I think the reason why I started thinking about this is because I've seen and been in community with people who feel on both sides that they can't express how they feel about Israel. People who think, well, I'm non-Zionist, or I really am against this war, but I can't say it. And I'm just going to keep to myself and not talk to anyone. And people who say, I really support Israel, and I'm offended that more people aren't supporting Israel, but I don't want to say anything right now. I don't know enough. I don't want to say anything. I don't want to get in a fight. And so then people are in community, sort of, but in this way where they're not actually, everything is left unsaid. And I feel like that's like this tension that's boiling over all the time. So you are hearing from people who are on really extreme sides who feel fully confident, but I think we're not hearing from a lot of people in the middle.
Describe the atmosphere that you see at the Beit Midrash and the House of Learning, maybe at Pardes or in other places in your life where this sort of like erupts. And I'm saying here that it's one thing to have your chevruta. So you and I are having a discussion, you and I going back and forth, but say there are 20 or 50 or 1,000 pairs having these different dialogues, which are sort of under a cone of silence. Like you're not sharing them, almost deliberately you're not sharing them with everybody else. So how does that, the one-on-one dynamic between you and your chevruta partner, begin to impact the rest of the learning environment that you're involved in?
So I think that the chevruta learning is sort of like, it gives you a practice of listening and engaging with someone from a place of curiosity and hearing someone disagree with you in real time. You are now practicing that skill. If you are in a Beit Midrash often, then you're practicing that all the time. It's like going to the gym. Like you're getting practice. You're working out those muscles. And then you can bring that into other bigger, maybe scarier conversations and places. But you will now have this practice where it's okay to disagree. It's okay to say what you think. And it's okay even to change your opinion and grow. And I think that it gives you, it's about the actual act of being in chavruta. That's where the learning happens. That the learning is less actually about like what you're disagreeing about. It's about the act of showing up with curiosity, with humility, with empathy, to cultivate the ability to have difficult conversations and for that to be okay.
And this, I think, is the essence of your article. Yes, it's about chavruta as the pedagogy or the means to get there, but it's really the point about machloket or division or argument. And here I think we need to add an extra phrase here, and maybe you can just teach us again about this phrase. It's machloket l'shem shamayim here, an argument for the sake of heavens, which I think is really the essence of what you're talking about. I guess I was surprised that it wasn't explicit in your piece, but talk to us a bit about what a machloket l'shem shamayim, an argument for the sake of the heavens, means for you as a Jewish educator.
I see it as like egoless. Do you know what I mean? It's not about winning. It's not about you convincing someone because you're the winner. It's about like being vulnerable and being real and being able to say like, I actually want to genuinely, like I believe in this thing and I'm saying this thing and now tell me what you think. And then the other person might say, I think differently and here's why. And now person A might be like, you know what? Maybe I changed my mind. Maybe I didn't. But they're actually open enough and willing enough to grow and learn from that conversation, not just to double down and debate it and fight it out. I don't mean that type of argument. Argument like machloket l'shem shamayim, I think is like a holy argument. Egoless. You're doing it because about the learning. It's about, like I would say, if it's in the Beit Midrash, it's about that text, but it's not text. I don't only mean like a piece of Torah. I mean that idea, that thing that's living, that's being created through the dialogue and through that conversation. You're creating something new. That's the Shemayim.
Okay. I'm going to pin this for another conversation. What I do want to ask you though, is that in a post-October 7th world, I hear a lot of people talking about the importance of solidarity or unity or coming together. And it makes me a bit nervous that you're suggesting pretty articulately here and unequivocally that it's actually pedagogy of argument, almost the antithesis of that solidarity or unity, which is what's going to be most important or essential to get us there. So how do you reconcile this need for peoplehood, which you articulated before as well, and solidarity with this notion that we need to fight in order to get there? Or is that how you see it?
I'm not saying like, hey, let's get people together and get them to fight. I don't support that. What I do support is this idea that I really believe that there is this disagreement that is under the surface, or it's coming up above the surface. And so look, we do need unity. We do need solidarity. And I don't want to cheer on machloket, but it's there. It's a part of our lives and it's there. And it's especially there around Israel. And so I think we need to allow people to bring that to the surface so that we can actually have unity. Because I think we can't have unity if you're telling, if people are just like only speaking to their little mini echo chamber. And I think a good example of unity with disagreement was the rally in DC, where I know there were organizations that were there that were in a separate space, but they still came. So I think that that's showing like, look, we don't agree with everything. We don't want to say we agree with everything, but we're still here. We're still here. And I also think in Israel, an example of that is that on October 6th, October 5th, there were all the protests going on for democracy. October 7th, everyone was called up and they went. Like there are disagreements and people are still coming together around a common cause sometimes.
So you're also an experiential educator, which by definition also means that you allow young people to reach their own conclusions. And by the way, you're not supposed to judge their conclusions.
Yep.
What happens if a kid does come to you and say, actually, I can't stand this country. I want nothing to do with it. I might even hate it.
So I actually think in my heart, I think that that's okay. I think my entire educational philosophy is around giving students, adults, kids, whoever they are, the opportunities to develop their own ideas and their own thoughts. And then I am creating the space for them to do that. And so the reason why I feel like it's so complicated around Israel is because since October 7th, I sometimes feel like people say things about Israel that might directly harm me or my family. And that's where it gets like so complicated because I want people to even to be like, okay, I want nothing to do with Israel. I'm Jewish. I want nothing to do with Israel. Great. Like, okay. And I used to say, that's fine. Anti-Zionist, fine. It's great. I'm good with whoever, as long as they're like empathetic and thoughtful people and human beings. And where I am struggling right now, like personally, this is just a huge struggle for me, is that I am afraid that when people are posting, are not only posting, but going to protests against Israel, encouraging America not to give aid to Israel, that that could end up meaning no Iron Dome, which means this safe room is going to be standing on its own in a pile of rubble, potentially. And that sounds really dramatic, but like, I'm afraid. And I don't, and not only me personally, but like the country. I live here. I want this country to succeed. I want this country to be better. I want this country to be amazing. I believe in this country. It doesn't mean I agree with the government, but I believe in its existence. And so I'm afraid that in my educational spaces of allowing people to think about their own ideas and develop their own ideas, that I might be encouraging people to actually develop dangerous and harmful ideas, and that's my fear.
You're living it out in Israel right now, but this is what's troubling me most about the current situation, is that the initial solidarity or unity of the people in a post-October 7th world now seemingly is being ripped apart at the seams. And I long for another day when there are arguments between people which truly respect and value one another. And I'm worried that divisions are actually going to tear us apart. But I think here you're offering that through learning and Jewish education, which is perhaps the greatest tool of survival the Jewish people have ever had and will continue to have, might be at the essence of not just being able to bring people together, create more learned educators, but actually be a really important longer-term strategy for the Jewish people.
I hope so. Amen.
Alana, this episode is going to be released just before Pesach, so I want you to give your best Pesach Torah that you can in 2024 for our adapting audience, largely because I think in this year, when we're asked to try and put ourselves as if ke'ilu we were exiting from Mitzrayim, the analogies are so clear for many of us, but maybe it's too close to home in some ways when we're talking about things like let my people go, and in every generation someone stood up against us to destroy us. But I want to give you the opportunity to be our teacher today before Pesach. Give us your best Pesach Torah that you can as we enter into this Chag of Freedom.
Oh my God. When you first even said that, I just like wanted to cry. There's like moments, I don't know, less now, but where I just like think about something and then just start crying. And I think thinking about Pesach, thinking about this idea of freedom when the hostages are not free and when we don't know what's happening with them, it's too painful. It's too painful for me to think beyond that. Like the only Torah I really have is that I want everyone to do whatever they can, which might just be posting on social media. It might just be clicking on the 1 minute a day thing, writing to your senators, writing to the president. Do whatever it takes to know that you're doing your part to try to get the hostages out. That's the Torah. Get the hostages out.
Can I just press you a bit? Because I think this is not going to be something which is uniquely happening for you this year in terms of that's your feeling. And when I even asked you the question, like tears were the first thing that you were thinking about, but you're going to get there to say tonight in front of your children. And educator and activist and communal professional is then going to be Imma and mother to your children. So imagine trying to think, like, how are you going to translate all of those feelings when you're with your children on Seder night?
I think I'm thinking very specifically about my own kids who are young, like 11, 9, and 6. I like the idea of constantly asking them questions about, you know, connecting it to their own personal lives of, you know, what was a moment when you felt free this week? Even it's hard for them to think past a week or even a day sometimes. What is something that you can do to help your friends feel more free? Like try to, if I'm thinking about the theme of freedom, which I was just thinking about when I was saying free the hostages. So I think about that theme of freedom and the value of freedom. So on the one hand, I personally see it as freedom, free the hostages. When I think about my kids, I think about like, what does freedom mean to them? And I think I would also ask them, what does it mean to you? And what's interesting is that now that I have kids who live in Israel, they might also bring up the hostages. They might also be thinking about that. The hostage pictures are everywhere here. And they know that I have a friend whose son is a hostage. So I don't know. I know that that's not explicit like Torah. I talk so much about bringing the text in. And then when you brought up Pesach now, it's like I just shattered and thought about this idea of freedom. I feel like we're so far from a place of freedom that it's hard for me to think past that. I also think like this is an example of why it's important for educators to like get their own head together and like let themselves have all these feelings first and then educate. So my advice to myself is like, hey, self, it seems like you're really feeling a lot of big feelings around this idea of freedom this year, but you're going to go be a teacher soon in a few weeks to your kids and your family and lead the Seder. So what are the things that I need to do before I lead a Seder? What are the like difficult feelings that I need to get out before I talk to my kids? And I don't want to freak them out. What do I need to do? Which I think is like part of the whole educational experience is reminding yourself as an educator that you are going to have big feelings. And sometimes you need to take care of those first before you can be a teacher.
It's interesting because I think, well, in so many ways, it's interesting. I can relate to so much of what you've said. It's interesting that there's a movement, at least in America, but I think in other communities around the world, to create your own Haggadah to meet the moment and to make sure that the pieces you have in the Haggadah are meaningful for where you are right now. And in some ways, I think one of the better responses, given what you've just said, is actually, no, use the traditional Haggadah, whatever that means to you, as your clutch right now. Like, just go back to what has always been for hundreds or decades, whatever it is in your own family tradition. Use that as your base, and then the modernity, the interpretation, doesn't necessarily need to be a whole Haggadah in itself, but the people around the table are in and of themselves that translation.
Yeah, and I think it depends on, because I have small kids, I would be thinking about it in terms of small kids. If you have adults and you want to have a bigger conversation around freedom and hostages on October 7th, then go for it, but make sure that you're in the right crowd for that.
Alana, I ask this question of all of my adapting guests, and you're no exception to that. I'm going to ask you to nominate or to talk a bit about an educator in your life who you think has made a huge impact on you, perhaps even transformed you and helped you along this educational journey. Who would that be?
Okay. So when I was at Midrashat Lindenbaum, I had a teacher named Rav Alex Israel. He actually worked at Pardes, but sadly we did not overlap. And he, for the first time in my Jewish learning life, he allowed me to just be me and ask the questions that were important to me and still took me seriously as a person and as a learner. And I had come from this Orthodox high school where I was always told that I was asking too many questions and it wasn't okay. And then Rav Alex met me where I was and taught me Torah in a serious way and saw me as a serious person, or at least I felt seen as a serious person as an 18-year-old. And that was really, really important to me and to my growth as a Jewish educator.
And now one last question, and just because I can see you on video, the listeners obviously can't. There's a Peloton in the background.
Oh, yeah.
Nominate your favorite Peloton instructor.
Cody, 100,000,000%.
And why do you have this connection to Cody Rigsby?
Oh, my God. A Cody class is like it's like anti-anxiety medication. Like a Cody class is my everything. It puts me in the best mood for the rest of the day. He's hilarious. He's fun. He makes it just delightful. Hilarious commentary about nachos and Britney Spears and who knows what. And I love it. Who's yours?
Now we're going into an in-depth conversation, which is an episode all on itself. And I have asked Jen Sherman before to appear on Adapting before. So I started off as a Jen Sherman fan, but over time I've progressed. Mm-hmm. And I now actually do my best workouts to Matt Wilpers because I'm into power zones. And I'm also really a fan of Ben Alidis when it comes to also writing. So it's some of the British influence also coming into my background as well.
Yeah, maybe.
Anyway, on that, I did do a live class with Ali Love, which was unforgettable. So,
so jealous.
I know. And on that note, let's bring this episode of Adapting to a close. Alana, I want to thank you for pulling back the curtain a bit on your own personal journey and to where Israel stands in your own Israel and your own Jewish educational philosophy and pedagogy as well. It's really important for me to have highlighted today that you have evolved over time in your relationship to Israel as part of your Jewish educator journey. And I really wanted to emphasize that in today's episode because I think, although yes, we're all unique, that the concept of going through a journey and not being the same educator that you were pre-October 7th as you are post-October 7th is something that is actually more ubiquitous than we've actually uncovered to date. And I really want to thank you for opening up that conversation with all of our guests today.
Thank you for having me.
Today's episode of Adapting was produced by myself, Dina Nussenbaum and Mirandela Peters. The show's executive producers are Karen Cummins and Nessa Lieben. Our show is engineered and edited by Nathan J. Bourne of NJB Media. If you enjoyed Adapting this season, please leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and even better still, share it with a friend. To learn more about the Jewish Education Project, please visit us at jewishedproject.org. You can learn more about our mission, history and staff. You can download all of our wonderful resources, especially about Pesach and especially as we enter into the time when we're talking about Yom HaShoah, Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut. As always, we are a proud partner of UJA Federation of New York. Thank you as always for listening today and Chag Sameach to everybody.